This is Games as a Podcast.
Hey, Ethan. How's it going?
Going good. Cool. Finally caught up on my sleep after staying up hours on ends to get a Switch 2 pre-order.
Yeah, I feel you. I can't wait to hear about your saga. Today, we've got a trio of topics. The first one is, in light of the recently relaunched Elder Scrolls 4 and the soon-to-be-launched Metal Gear Solid 3 remake, we thought we'd talk a little more about remakes and what makes for a great one and what makes for maybe not great one. And then leaning in on the Elder Scrolls 4, just talking about RPGs in general. We both think it's amazing how even the most core gaming concepts make their way to the mainstream. And it's really cool to see a title like Oblivion, that's 20 years old, pop back into the consciousness and captivate people. And then lastly, we'll wrap up with some thoughts, comments about the Switch 2 pre-order madness. But first, Ethan, I'd love to hear about what you've been playing, what's in your heavy rotation.
Yeah, actually, I stepped back 30 plus years in time this week. Spent a lot of time playing Genesis games. Just picked up my analog SG. I don't know if you've ever seen those little machines, which are like new versions of classic consoles. So this is
a miniature version of the console. Yes.
And HDMI in. Mm-hmm. And so it looks beautiful on HD sets. Pop that in to play a little Mickey Mouse Castle of Illusion. They take original cartridges, so that's super fun. And just had such a good time with that. It was just the kind of pure distilled action platform with predictable, fun jumping, butt bouncing, and enemies that are not too hard once you figure out their patterns. And I just really enjoyed playing until I lost all my lives, and then just starting from the beginning and trying to do it again. That's a very old way of playing games, but I love it. That's something we just don't see that much, because progression, as we'll talk about later in the episode, has become so important that you're never really asked to just start from the beginning again. When's the last time that you can remember playing something that was really just this linear play till you die, then start over?
Ooh, in a minute. Yeah, not even mobile games do that really anymore, or much.
Yeah, so it may have been decades for you too. It was a long time for me.
Yeah, it was probably an emulated collection, Sonic or something like that.
Yep.
Just for nostalgia's sake. Yeah, it's interesting. The arcade experiences, well, I guess early console experiences, very much an arcade one, very linear, and oftentimes punishing.
Yes, for sure. Well, something that I have is a bit of a ritual. Fortunately, in the Bay Area, there are multiple retro shops, and they have just an incredible library of games that you can go and buy. And I like every Friday to go to a place called Save and Continue. Mm-hmm. I'll go there and I'll pick up one Genesis game or one Super Nintendo game. And then I'll go to Togo's right next door and have a nice sandwich and go back to work. It's a really fun tradition. And this week I ended up picking up Double Dragon 3, the arcade game on Sega Genesis. Mm. So decided to pick that up, not because it's supposed to be good, because it sure isn't, but because I would have loved to have gotten it when I was younger, never had it. And it is based on a barely seen arcade game that was called Double Dragon 3 The Rosetta Stone. And unlike the NES Double Dragon 3, this was a Western studio trying to do their very best to make a frame-for-frame port of the arcade game itself. Oh, and so it was kind of neat to see that. Yeah, like if you were watching long plays of both the arcade game and the Genesis game, they are fundamentally the same. And they're equally terrible. The arcade game was known to be awful because it had these wretched frame rates, and it actually was the first game in arcades to have microtransactions. You could actually buy not just extra guys, but extra weapons and extra skills and things like that in the shops. So that was
mid-play,
something.
They'd ask you for quarters? Or...
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Really? Wow. Mm-hmm. I mean, arcade games are the original microtransaction game anyways, right?
Yeah, you're
sinking quarters in.
This doubles down. Yeah, so
Double Dragon's down.
Yep. So the game itself, again, is not good, but it just reminds me how context is everything, because as a kid, if I knew that it was almost exactly like the arcade, that would have been enough to excite me. Like, I have the arcade game at home, right?
And your brain can fill in the blanks anyways, because when you're at home, that you're feeling like you have that arcade experience, even if the graphical fidelity isn't the same, which is, it's amazing how far we've come in terms of graphics.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then...
Question about how does the console version handle the microtransaction bit? Do you just hit select to buy stuff in the store, or...
Yeah, at the beginning, they allow you to choose either you have 15 quarters that you're taking with you or 25. And that kind of becomes a difficulty thing, right? So,
gotcha.
Yeah, and that's fine. And it actually allows you to calculate, like, how many times you need to play it before you've justified the, in this case, $20 spend. But, yeah. So that was fun. And then just playing around with those got me to jump back into Nintendo Switch Online. One of the coolest things that Nintendo does, because, boy, they really understand players my age that are nostalgic. They made available in the Nintendo Store a Genesis controller that is a perfect recreation of the Genesis controller, complete with a logo and everything on it, the three-button pad. Hmm. And... when you have that, they did the same with Super Nintendo and N64 and NES controllers. But when you're playing those classic games on the machine and it's on your TV, having that controller in your hand really does transport you. It's a pretty powerful nostalgia push. It's much better than holding like a Switch controller.
Sure.
So I decided to jump back to Phantasy Star 4. Just kind of on a lark, I thought maybe I'd play the first half hour or something just to get a taste. That's often what I will do with classic games, but it hooked me, and I ended up putting about 4 hours into it and look forward to playing more of it. There are some things that are clunky. You can't see, for instance, when you're at a shop, if the weapons that they have in stock are more powerful than what you currently have. You have to kind of buy and guess. Yeah. But the graphics are quite good. The cutscenes are good. And one thing that's really notable is when it originally came out in the U.S., and bear in mind, this was 1994, so the game's more than 30 years old. But when it came out, it was $100 retail because it came on a really large cart and almost was a Sega CD game, but they ultimately figured that the audience would be bigger if they released it on cartridge. So that asking price, think about it, you know, even before inflation, it's the price that everyone's been talking about for Grand Theft Auto 6, and it's way beyond what Nintendo is asking for Mario Kart World, which is upsetting people, and that was in 1994.
That was $216 in today's cash.
Can you believe it? Yeah.
That's amazing.
And there's kind of a prestige that's tied with it because, by extension, it meant that there are fewer copies. Now, copies in the wild are even more than $100, as you can imagine. But
more than $200, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, especially if it's in box. But it's a really good game, and it's kind of neat that it's just one of 50 games you can play on the Nintendo Switch from the Genesis era. Mm-hmm. Most people don't even realize what they have on their hands there. This super rare and expensive gameplay experience, but it's really, really cool. And I love sometimes going back like that and getting back in touch with the 14-year-old version of me.
Definitely, the nostalgia trip is palpable. Speaking of Oblivion.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know if you've had a chance yet to jump into this, but it is on Game Pass. And it's crazy for me to start playing Oblivion again because that is one of the ultimate comfort food games for me.
Mm-hmm.
I just love traveling around, doing side quests. The gameplay mechanics are still quite simple. It's just block and slash for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
But that sense of exploration paired with a really beautiful update graphically. I mean, the game just looks night and day different. It looks so much better than any Skyrim that you've played. I hope they do this for Skyrim as well. But really polished and just incredible that it's been 20 years.
Yeah, I can't believe that.
Yeah, it's like when I first played it, I was single. I had no kids, of course. And now I have a daughter. So it's like, it just feels crazy that much time has passed. And yet, when I pop that thing in, it feels like no time has passed at all. It really ages well and brings you back to a different time.
That's That's cool. It doesn't surprise me. I've seen the screenshot comparisons of the upmaster or remaster. Very, very impressive what they've done to make it look beautiful. And of course, the gameplay is solid. I think I spent more than 80 hours playing it. I'm kind of torn. My backlog of titles to play is so long as it is. I tend to bias towards playing something new than revisiting something that I've already spent a ton of time in. But that said, I am very curious to see what it might be like to go in and replay, or at least the first sequence would be kind of fun to play again. I really enjoyed Skyrim more than Oblivion too, so I kind of, if I want that experience, I feel like maybe I would just fire up Skyrim and play some more. But I don't know. You're kind of swaying me towards leaning towards at least checking it out.
Yeah, it's definitely worth looking at. And it really is an interesting example of bringing a game back. I think about movies, and when I will go to the Alamo and I'll take my son to go see something like Chinatown or The Godfather, it's as good now as it was 50 years ago. Games are at a disadvantage there.
Yep.
Because games very quickly become nostalgic. And maybe still good, maybe fun. It's still fun to play Sonic the Hedgehog 2 or Super Mario Bros. 3. But it's just riddled with the generation's technical limitations, whether it's color palette or frame rate or 2D versus 3D. And movies, again, a classic is a classic. And you can go back and Brando and Pacino are still amazing in The Godfather. And it can still move new audiences without anything more than maybe a digital remaster. Right? Improving the resolution of a video print. But games, I think it's really interesting when you look at, say, what Sony's doing specifically with something like The Last of Us. They have this television show that's super popular, and they have consistently updated The Last of Us to be cutting edge on whatever platform you're playing on. So that first game came out on PlayStation 3. And at the time, it was the game that made you say, okay, PS3 really is more powerful than the Xbox 360.
Wasn't it? It was very late stage PS3, though, right?
Yes.
It was basically, this is the apotheosis of what you could do with the platform.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really interesting on PlayStation 3 to compare it to like Naughty Dog's own like Uncharted 1. Mm-hmm. The jumps were remarkable. But the thing is when the PlayStation 4 came out, they did a polish of the game, yep, specifically for PS4. And then they did it again for PS5, bringing the graphics up to what you would expect from PlayStation 5. And it really is beautiful when you play it on PlayStation 5. Same thing with Last of Us Part 2, which also got an overhaul. And that was just from PS4 to PS5. But the PS5 version of The Last of Us 2 might be the best looking game on the platform. It's really amazing. Yeah. But they're keeping it modern.
They are. I think it's certainly in their interest to keep their IP fresh and also to help push their latest generation of consoles. We've talked a little bit about this in the past, and I think even you kind of drew a line in the sand and said that improvements past PS4 are maybe superfluous. So it's interesting to hear you kind of come back and extol the virtues of these titles. For sure, I'm not going to argue they look better, but going back to the movie metaphor, I almost think that any game that was made or debuted on PS4 or later is probably fine to experience for the first time in that format and doesn't necessarily need a huge overhaul. Something like Oblivion, certainly it's almost night and day when you see something that's 20 years old that has been up-resed and true to form. But I would almost argue, I guess maybe it depends on the game, that you can get a pretty awesome experience from a game that has come out at that generation or older and maybe doesn't need that level of upgrading. And maybe the reason to do so is, well, I think at the end of the day, it's always about money, but it's more about the company either wanting to push their console or keep their IP fresh. And I think it'd be interesting to keep the conversation to folks have gone above and beyond to provide kind of that stellar remake, whether it's taking something that's 20 years old and refreshing it with the best of breed graphics or those that kind of brought a fresh new perspective. I guess typically it's going to be a graphical improvement if it's a remake as opposed to like a sequel or a rejuvenation of the IP. So maybe we should keep it to that. And I guess almost definitionally it's going to probably be much older games that have been refreshed. And what you said about movies is interesting because there are classics that will always be classics, but there are also movies that get remakes almost every generation. Spider-Man. It's, I guess, not surprising that we see that in games also, because every 10 years you're going to have another cohort of people that probably never heard of a given game. So it does make sense to kind of dust these things off and to present them in with fresh, new, shiny graphics.
Fair point. And looking at what post-processing on a more powerful piece of hardware can do, sometimes that alone is enough to make a game look shiny and new. So Xbox is a really interesting example where on some Xbox 360 games, double the frame rate and add HDR. And so I replayed Sonic Generations before they did a new version of it. And it looked stunning. It was incredible. It looked like they completely rebuilt it graphically. It looked completely contemporary. So it must not have been the heaviest of all lifts to do that in the remake, because if just procedurally doing double frame rate in HDR gave you great returns, right?
Yep.
But to Sega's enormous credit, when they released the new version of Sonic Generations, they added all of that shadow content,
right?
Which was like half a game unto itself. And it was a really interesting solution. You can imagine, we've been there before. Probably they knew that the third movie was coming out and Shadow was a big part of it, and they wanted to tie to that somehow, but they weren't going to have a game from Sonic Team ready in time. So what about half a game that's stapled onto a classic game that you could reissue that people loved? And turned out that was a great approach. And
yeah, for sure.
That was really interesting to see, too, because Generations, the first one did not come out on a Nintendo platform because it was, other than the DS, but like the real version of the game never came out on the Wii because we couldn't handle it. Now it was really neat to see it on a Nintendo platform, and it ran just as well on the Switch as it did on the PlayStation 5. I actually bought it twice, so I need to see each version of them. But, you know, so that's an interesting way to do it, is to just add new content. I know that Kirby is getting new content for the Switch 2 as well. And so they're going to make that available for like $20 if you own the original game, along with doubling the frame rates. But if you want to buy the game as a Switch 2 game, it's going to be like $80. So kind of interesting. That's one way to do it, is to just add new content. Another thing that's been popular that I've really appreciated is the full ground up experience. And to your point, it's usually done when a game is like PlayStation 1 era or older. Two that really stand out to me is Resident Evil 2, which just felt more like Resident Evil 4, but really got rid of those tank controls, was super slick looking, again, felt totally modern, but it had the earmarks of that classic game that really deeply touched my nostalgia nerve, so much that like I ended up playing that game over and over again and really loved it. I love that it started a whole trend for Capcom to reissue their Resident Evil games, because then a remake of RE3 came out, and then their Resident Evil 4 remake was fantastic. And it's just such a great way to recapture the flavor of those games and allow people, if they're invested in a long-term narrative, to be able to do that in a way that doesn't make them feel like they have to go back to these like long load times and you know, the tank controls and all this stuff that is very unplayer friendly. Definitely a cool way to do it. And again, I think a lot of it is Capcom, one, refreshing the value of their brands, two, giving perhaps their development teams something to do while they're working on something new and bigger, right? If it's a big window of pre-production and they can use the bones of an old game to make something that might be efficient from a production standpoint. And three, again, just reaching out to their older audience and giving them a bone every once in a while is pretty nice, because these games tend not to, they don't turn them into like big open world 100-hour long games. They still stick to the kind of like, this is 20 hours of fun,
right?
Which is part of the nostalgia.
And I think it also gives them an opportunity to find new fans. So it's a lot harder for someone to kind of stumble upon Resident Evil if it hadn't been remade. So I'm sure that Capcom won over some new fans as a result, and that is obviously good for the IP and good for revenue in the long run.
Yeah, it's a starting point thing, isn't it? Like, if they want people to experience the whole thing. I remember from Sega's standpoint, when we were doing Sonic the Hedgehog Part 4, Izuka-san was very, very focused on making sure that you could play the entire series on the Wii. He wanted to make sure there's one place, if you're a Sonic fan, to go to where you could experience the entire story. I get that. It's nice to have everything in one place like that.
For sure. It probably is less important today, just because content seems to be less platform specific, but I appreciate the focus there to service the Sonic fan and to have all that stuff available to them on that one platform, for sure.
Yeah. Well, something that was interesting during the launch of the PS5, which I still can't believe that was already 5 years ago, but when Demon's Souls came out, the Souls-likes were all super popular. Obviously, this is pre-Elden Ring, but what a neat way to not only bring back one of the games most people hadn't played, because that was prior to Dark Souls, but they brought it back, and by, again, using the bones of that old game, we're able to focus on just visual polish. And to this day, it's one of the best looking games on the PS5. It's not up to Last of Us Part 2, which kind of is the crown for me, but like, it still was maybe the only game at launch that made me say, oh, there really is a difference between what this can do and what the PlayStation 4 can do. So imagine if they had tried to just build a game from the ground up in that time frame and make it look like that and play like that. It's just such a great shortcut to be able to have something to begin with.
Yeah, and I think it's probably likely that this will become more the norm as back catalogs get older and older, production costs get higher and higher. You're going to see people that own IP turn to kind of dusting them off and looking to enhance and release or re-release these games in order to fill roadmaps, fill calendars, and also to get things out on a relatively cost-efficient basis.
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting too, because there is those economies of scale where not only would people kind of get upset if you were to, say, do a Return of the King remake or something, because people are so familiar with the original, but to do that, you'd have to truly start from the ground up as if there had never been a prior film. Here, you do have some foundations. And again, that's what's so neat about Oblivion, is that the old game is there underneath it. They've improved some of the battle mechanics. They've made UI a little easier to navigate. And again, huge graphical change, but it is the same game. And in fact, there have been times, when Halo 2 got a beautiful remake, you could press a button and it would allow you to see the game in its original version.
Oh, really?
And cool. And then press back and then go back to the new aesthetic, which was really kind of neat to see.
That is very cool. I like that.
Because what always happens is, and this is certainly the case with Oblivion, is when I turned it on, I was struck by how beautiful it was, but also I was struck by how beautiful the original was 20 years ago. So it allows me to experience the game as I remember it, not as it actually was. Because if I popped in the original, I'd be like, ooh, this looks a little crusty, you know?
It looks like Minecraft.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So a couple of other interesting examples. I wanted to speak to Silent Hill 2, because I think what's interesting there is Konami's reputation as a game company, let's be honest, was kind of in the toilet for a long time. It seemed like they didn't know what to do with their big brands. So when they'd try to do like a Contra remake, it would be just absolutely terrible. Or if it was the Castlevania series, they made it a free-to-play game that they didn't launch and ended up stitching into a Apple Arcade game. And it just was very messy, all of that. Even their soccer games, my understanding, they kind of fell off a cliff in terms of quality. So Silent Hill 2 is announced, and it's from Bloober Team, who is an outside developer that has an inconsistent track record, and people were not expecting much, and it turned out to be as good as the Resident Evil remakes. Really excellent and scary. Very scary. And that's super cool, because you do that, and they have Metal Gear Solid 3 coming, as you were saying at the top of the show. Now, suddenly, people are much more optimistic about what that's going to be. And probably a smart thing to do, because they still have a lot of Kojima's team members, if not Kojima himself, So I'm sure that that will be a well done remake, and it can resuscitate Konami's entire brand, those two games.
Definitely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think they finally got it right in terms of how to handle their crown jewels, and I look forward to seeing Metal Gear 3 and see what they do with it.
Yep. Well, and then Nintendo themselves have been kind of canny with this. I don't know if you ever played Metroid Samus Returns on the 3DS, but that was a Mercury Steam game. They did Metroid Dread. And this was 3DS. They did a remake of Metroid 2 from the Game Boy. And you wouldn't think that the story of Metroid on Game Boy would be meaningful, but it was meaningful enough to Nintendo to where they found this team that loved that clunky original game and were eager to rebuild it with the same story. And the game turned out really quite good. And that's another just kind of interesting example of modernizing a game. So, you know, yes, you can go back for nostalgia's sake to that pea green version of the game, but it's really neat that there's a new one that is actually much more playable and more fun.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the Switch 2 yields. Obviously, we have a sneak peek at some of the stuff that's coming, but it will definitely be interesting to see how Switch 1 classics make their way to the platform, or even older classics. You do have the GameCube collection, I guess, that's coming to
yep.
Switch 2, which I'm looking forward to playing myself. So more of that, I'm sure, is coming. It'll be interesting to see.
For sure. And one thing that's important, though, is that it's not necessarily a license to print money. So the Crash Bandicoot Insane Trilogy did super well for Activision. So well, in fact, that they greenlit Toys for Bob doing Crash Bandicoot 4, which ended up tanking. So, you know, that's an interesting...
Tread carefully.
Right. And Dead Space also, if you remember, EA finally did a really terrific remake of Dead Space. It just looks fantastic on modern consoles, but it didn't sell well enough. And so apparently there were plans for a Dead Space 2 and 3. That's the rumor anyway. And that got scrapped and the studio just moved on to something else. But it's really too bad because... That was such a good game. So again, like, maybe it doesn't work every time. Maybe expectations are too high in some cases. But I'm glad that there are things like that. And I wonder what Square's going to do post Final Fantasy VII remake, because that they decided to turn into multiple games.
Yeah, multiple. What is it? $70 games, I believe.
Yes. Yeah. And yeah. So remake did really well, but remake came out during COVID. And so, and there was this high novelty based on the idea of, like, finally they're taking the most popular Final Fantasy game and making it in contemporary graphics and gameplay. But Rebirth, the second game, which is clearly more expensive than the first one, it's PS5 natively, but it has so much more content and mini games and cutscenes. And that apparently didn't sell nearly as well as Remake. So the novelty factor was, satiated, and I think you always have the issue of people saying, well, I didn't finish all the content in Remake, so I'm not going to get that second one yet.
Yeah, I think you're also running into some of the challenges of sequelitis and just having a huge amount of content under one IP, and it becomes harder to differentiate unless you're the super, super fan. Maybe harder to find an audience, even if all the time and money has been sunk into upresing the graphics or producing a new version, iteration of that IP.
Yeah. Well, so Chris, is there any game or set of games that you would love to see remade, that if that happened, you'd jump on it day one?
I think it would be kind of fun to, and I know some of this has been done in the past, but just go super old school to like Atari 2600 and bring out... Like adventure, like what would adventure look like if it were brought into today's standard? Obviously, it would be a super deep RPG, but I'd like to think someone could capture the spirit of the original and not for it to have to be a $200 million game. Those games still are so interesting because the developers were working with such immense constraints in terms of technologically.
Yep.
And I feel like today there are constraints, but they're just of a different type. And I think the constraints are almost end user constraints. People only have so many hours in a day. So how can you kind of look at the games that captivated people back then and reimagine them today into something. And I would really love to see what that might look like.
Well, did you ever pick up the Atari 50?
The Atari 50, is that the mini console thing?
No. This was a software. It was for Nintendo Switch or PS5. And So Digital Eclipse, the team that was once called Other Ocean, right? They have been, if I remember correctly, purchased by Atari. But one of their releases was a really terrific kind of deluxe repackaging of all of the like most important games from the Atari 2600 era, and they did exactly what you're talking about.
Ignorant.
No, it's something to investigate though, because they remade some of the classic games, and they did it in a more modern art style, and yeah, obviously they didn't turn it into $50 million games, but it was really kind of neat to be able to play some of these and Warlord and stuff like that, and see what the modern interpretation was. And apparently they chose just based on which games they loved the most. And so I think Combat was another one on there. But yeah, it's just kind of neat to see that. And Atari's done that in the past. They had PlayStation 1 games, actually, that was like a new version of Pong. It was one of the first things that I actually reviewed when I was a game critic. So yeah, it is. You can bring those things back and have a lot of fun with them. And in many cases, the core gameplay is still a blast. I'd love to see River Raid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's funny to think that that is an Activision title and that company still exists in name.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we've been talking a lot about the remakes, and what I think has also been interesting, you know, Oblivion, of course, is an RPG, and Clair Obscur Expedition 33 is a game that's getting 90s in reviews, and it's on Game Pass as well, and that just came out this week. So it's been a really heavy RPG week.
Yeah, definitely.
When I was a kid, if you owned a Genesis, you were one of two types of people. You either had it so you could play games like Dark Wizard and Phantasy Star 4, and that was me, or you had it for Madden and NHL, and that was everyone else.
Yep.
I can't say qualitatively which one is better, but I will say that when you go to the game shops, some of those cartridges are like 25 cents and some of them are hundreds of dollars, and the ones I liked were hundreds of dollars, so... There's something to that. I remember talking to a coworker who, when he heard that I was going every week and buying cartridges, he's like, oh, I got a bunch of them at home. I could make a mint just selling those. And I'm like, oh, cool. Which ones do you have? And he was talking about, like, you know, the NHLs and the NBAs. And I said, okay, well, you'll get nothing for that. You had to have been a nerd with a nerd collection to get value out of that.
Yeah, it's nice to see that some things don't change and that there's still a healthy appetite for RPGs. And once was... like you said, it's a pretty niche genre, can be seen in games of all stripes. Like I think you mentioned before we jumped on, Call of Duty is basically an RPG now. And I think the idea of progression, character progression and persistence is something that is evident and almost certainly you can find it in every genre. And it seems to be ubiquitous in games, just full stop, even mobile games. And I think that has certainly led to the play patterns that we see today, people spending more and more time with more and more games or even more and more time with a handful of games because there is that those systems are in place to engage you and to retain you because you have the sense of value that you've put into the character or the team that you're building, etc. And so it's not too surprising to me that we're seeing interest in Oblivion and Clair Obscur because they're the kind of OG retention genre RPG. You know, life is an RPG, right? So I think it's no wonder to me that it still resonates today.
Yeah, well, there's so many things that it does, even if it started as a more hardcore set of mechanics, it does some things that actually I think very casual players can appreciate as well. So one example is there is a certain comfort I have when I play an RPG or a game with RPG systems. Because what it indicates to me is that if I'm not particularly good at a game, I can grind and over time, I can balance my lack of skill with just a more powerful kit or better weapons and more strength. And I can go back to this boss that maybe somebody extremely good at the game could nail on a first pass. I just get wiped out, but I can come back and attack them when I have just more grind behind my characters.
Yeah, the gear grind and then later the skill grind certainly is a powerful mechanic. It's not just requiring you to become physically better at the game. It rewards play, it rewards exploration, which I think is why the genre has persisted and rewards different types of players and different types of player interests.
Yeah. Though I think that those things, you have to be fair with it in these games. Some of the challenges actually of older RPGs would be that if you didn't master certain buffs and macros and things like that,
yeah,
the game would just wipe you out. And I think that there's a certain ceiling for skill or even just understanding systems that some people have. And some people really like to just press the X button and hit attack, 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 and ultimately prevail.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's almost a cheat if a game is set up so that you can do that through all of the kind of characters you grind through, but then you hit a boss and you have to suddenly be very skillful and know exactly when to apply which spell and things like that. And I think that games like Call of Duty actually did streamline that nicely to where you don't hit those kinds of walls. You are constantly feeling the RPG feeling of satisfaction and moving forward. They don't really bar you the way some of those classic Final Fantasy games did.
Yes, and I guess it should be clear that you're not talking about a game like Elden Ring where they're very upfront about the fact that you hit a wall and that wall is persistent. You better
right.
get good. Yeah.
But even Elden Ring, you can bring in help.
Yeah. Yeah, and you do. There are areas that you can venture into and get your ass handed to you and then realize, oh, I'm in over my head. I'll come back when I kind of gear up or get a little more skilled. So, yeah, even in a punishing game like that, those systems still persist.
Well, and I would go so far as to say when you look at something like first-person shooters, any game that doesn't have some type of RPG progression, if it came out today, that would not be a satisfying meta to people. And they would probably not adopt it. I think it's kind of table stakes now to just have something like that.
Yeah, and I don't think it needs to exist in the form of a season pass type grindy system either. I think people just expect to be rewarded in some way for the time they spend in a game. And certainly there's exceptions. There are the the smaller 8 to 10 hour type experiences that are contained in and of themselves. And again, there's nothing wrong with those games. In fact, sometimes I find myself gravitating towards them because I know that there's an upper limit to how much time I'm going to spend in the game. But I think for the big folks, there definitely is the basic ante that you need those systems in place to make it interesting. And it's probably challenging from a design perspective because I think at the very core, you want to make sure that the fun is there without all the trappings that make the people return to the game. And I think sometimes you can probably get lost in the weeds a little bit because you're trying to think on so many different levels about all the different systems you need to implement. And I know there are challenges there to make sure to start with first principles. So like, okay, this core thing is fun. It is intrinsically fun in and of itself, and it's not overly reliant on all of these meta layers and systems. And I think if there's any guilty parties, they probably veer towards the mobile gaming sphere, which has sometimes been more interested in the systems than the actual game itself, which maybe is a function of the platform and the typical gameplay session that someone has on the platform.
Well, yeah, and mobile, I think it really makes a lot of sense if they're focusing more on the meta just because the action gameplay is more limited necessarily because you don't have
True.
A controller.
Yep, good point, good point.
The other thing, too, is the mobile games are based very much on just improving the meta where it's less about, and I think players understand this, they might not communicate this when they're talking about it, but they're less based on skill. It's more based on kind of the pleasure of advancing, getting better, seeing your stats improve, and not about getting good.
Yeah, that's true. Although the original Cookie Clicker game was a PC game, so...
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true. I think what's also really interesting is that RPG is a somewhat complicated metagame concept, yet audiences have started to come to expect it. And now, again, even the most broad casual player knows what RPG elements do in a game and come to expect them and enjoy them. So that's been something that's been interesting to see as well. It reminds me a bit, again, looking at say, television compared to games, where maybe your grandparents were watching Dragnet, and that was such a very simple police procedural. But then, you know, we grew up on 24, where everything was set in real time and multiple things happening on screen at the same time, and a level of complexity that our grandparents would kind of throw up trying to watch, right?
Going to film, that's super interesting to see the evolution over time from the old school black and white talkies, where they were basically plays on film, where you'd have pretty long periods of dialogue between one another and maybe just a couple different set changes, to things that are more complicated, more interesting from a narrative perspective. You know, Orson Welles, I think, brought in a lot of that. This is not a movie podcast, but then flash forward to, I think, the MTV, I think cable TV generation just brought like this quick cut type style that became pervasive in movies. And I think even like a movie today, depending on the movie, of course, but like a mass market film probably has an order of magnitude more cuts than even a movie from 15 years ago, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And we'll probably edit that out because it's we're talking about movies now, but whatever.
But the point is art forms become more sophisticated and grow with the audience. Mm-hmm. And the audience comes to want more. And, you know, that's something that we can see with the language of games. It's that this has become such an expectation that whether you're talking about a racing game or an action RPG or a Souls-like, they all have some type of RPG mechanic. It's just baked deeply into the DNA of games now.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a bad thing, because I love RPGs, you love RPGs, and maybe it brings a little level of comfort and familiarity when we're checking out a new game and it's got some kind of system or mechanic that we're used to or comfortable with.
Yeah, and it also gives better justification for playing a game that's 100 hours long. Now, sometimes there are challenges in balancing that. Going back to Oblivion and Skyrim, some people love it, some people hate it, but the way that levels is the environment basically levels alongside your character.
Yeah.
And on one end, it allows it to be more accessible. You can just mainline the story and feel like you can get a good experience in a relatively short period of time, or you can suck the marrow out of the bones and play forever. But it's like other people really don't like that and prefer the idea of like there are certain areas that you're just going to get whooped until you're strong enough to go into. What are your thoughts on that?
I am more of the frame of mind that the more people that can enjoy the experience, the better. Although I don't begrudge a developer, a designer saying, well, this is a hardcore game for hardcore people, and that's fine. But personally, if I'm making a game, I want as many people as possible to enjoy it. So there's no reason not to have a gradated difficulty. So if I want to play a game on, you know, cinematic mode, where it's basically just letting me have easy action sequences and get into it, and if you want a super hardcore mode where you one shot and you're dead, permadeath type thing, I think that that's ideal. Certainly that's harder to build, more expensive to build, so smaller teams might not have the luxury of doing something like that. But I personally don't mind a system that evolves as your characters, or not system, but an environment that evolves or levels up as your characters leveling up. It makes it easier to do for open world. It's, I think, almost a necessity. Otherwise, you just run into, it becomes a less open world and more linear, because you need to go from point A to point B to get more powerful so you can go back to point C to defeat someone. So it removes an element of gameplay that makes open world so appealing. So I think it really depends on the genre, I guess, and the nature of the game.
Well, and to close out on this, you know, speaking of genre, it's interesting because while I did just say that just about everything I play now has some RPG system, it's really interesting to see when that doesn't happen. And Split Fiction is actually a really good example of that. There's no RPG in that. It's just pure action gameplay that focuses its novelty on what it's like to play a game that's built custom for two people.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, and it works because I think it is a love letter homage to all different types of game genres. So you've kind of got like the 2D platformy type stuff. You've got obviously sci-fi theme and fantasy theme, so I think they can kind of get away with it because it's almost like a smorgasbord of different types of games that is really appealing. And I think that's what makes it really appealing.
Yeah. Well, I will say that probably the best console of all time, in my opinion, for RPGs, and I'm talking more now traditional RPGs, is the Nintendo Switch. Mm. It's, you know, even if you want your Skyrim fix, that's on the machine. Yep. But there's just between classics and reissues and brand new games, there's so much traditional RPG goodness on the Nintendo Switch that you could love that genre and that genre alone and play your Switch for 10 years. I am very confident about that.
I would say PC is the same way, but yeah.
Yeah, I could see that for sure. I guess it's just for me, the Switch, well, now you have the Steam Deck as well, so you can kind of do that wherever you want. But there's a coziness oftentimes to playing a traditional RPG where it's almost like reading a book or like, you know, you want to carry it with you and just grind when you have a couple of minutes free.
Yeah, depending on the RPG, it becomes like an eye test reading a book because the fonts render very poorly at small resolutions. But that's probably a vote in favor of the Switch because they're probably a little better optimized.
Yep. And so many games like that. And one of the things I think that made the Switch so successful was that it was not in the graphics arm race. So you had games that like Red Dead Redemption that were kind of 360 era that were exciting to see on there and tons of original first party games, but they weren't needing to race to keep up with the PS4 or the Xbox One, and certainly it's far, far behind PS5 and Xbox Series X and modern PC. But now we have some catch-up time, and apparently the Switch 2 is 10 times more powerful than the original Switch, and yet it's 100% backwards compatible, so all of these great experiences that I was just saying in the RPG realm, just as an example, are all going to carry over, and they will be the same. I'm excited about the Switch 2, but I'm having a hard time articulating why, other than the hype cycle. And
not enough.
Well, it's kind of a 1.5, but then again, it is like the Super Nintendo. It's the same thing, but a lot more powerful, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But you skipped the first generation of Switch. Sounds like you're interested in this one.
Oh, yeah.
Why?
Time, I think. We talked a little bit about this previously, but just to TLDR it, I was interested in getting a Switch, and then the scalpers just kind of took over for, I don't know, 6 to 8 months, and I just kind of lost the interest and appetite. I certainly have played Switch games. I've borrowed friends' Switches for weekends and gotten to play the Zeldas and the new games that have come out. I then also got very interested in, on the PC side of things, because professionally, I was in the PC gaming space, and there's just so much content available on that side, on the PC side. I didn't really feel like I was missing out that much. Mm. And it's been a long time since I bought a Nintendo platform, so I think I'm just excited to kind of get back in there and play the latest and greatest, and probably borrow heavily from your amazing library. And just, yeah, I'm excited. I probably would have picked up a Switch by now if I hadn't gotten a Steam Deck, actually. So I think it'll be interesting to have the Steam Deck and the Switch 2 and see how my play across the two differs, what I gravitate towards on each of those platforms.
For me, there's two big, big differences between what I'm expecting out of the Switch 2 and the Steam Deck, which I also have. Mm. The first, of course, and most importantly, are the Nintendo first party stuff, right? Obviously,
of course, yeah.
That's the only place you can play Mario Kart. But beyond that, one thing that I've always loved about the first Switch was just how perfect and elegant switching from the big screen to the handheld was. Mm. And that is not something that is nearly as fluid or intuitive on the Steam Deck. Steam Deck is really good for handheld gaming, and you can buy a dock that allows you to put it to the big screen TV, but it's just not a good experience. It doesn't just instantly do it and resizes everything perfectly the way it does on the Switch. It doesn't feel like it's meant for that. It feels like you're more supposed to like play Steam Deck handheld and then cloud save over to your PC, which is fine, I guess. But I just I like being able to sit in front of my big TV and play, and so that is something that I think no one does better than Nintendo. There's also the battery life. There's the ease of just jumping into the game in two button presses. They really know how to make sure that all the friction is removed from the experience, and I think Steam Deck is not as interested in that.
Yeah, the Steam Deck is a portable PC, and with that comes all of the fiddly bits. I would almost liken it between iOS and Android in a lot of cases. So if you like to fiddle and customize your setup, settings, etc., and tune, basically, the Steam Deck is probably a good option for you. You can customize everything. Whereas if you just wanted to play games and do it well, the Switch is obviously plug and play ready, has an amazing library, obviously very well curated. The comparisons start to fall flat when you talk about first party games and whatnot, but I think it does hold somewhat. And I totally agree with you. That's why I'm looking forward to spending some time with the Switch and comparing it to my time with the Deck. It will probably be mostly first party titles on the Switch, and then everything else on the Deck and or PC.
Yep. Well, one thing that has become clearer now that we're getting closer to launch, have you heard of the Key cartridges that are becoming more popular?
I have, and I've seen that at least in Japan, it looks like most of the physical copies are actually Key cartridges, which I find kind of funny. So you're basically paying an extra $10 for a piece of plastic that will then download the game to the cart.
Yes. Well, there are some benefits beyond that. Another thing that is kind of nice about them is the lock isn't on the system level, it's on the cartridge. So if you're in the maybe unique position I'm in, where we are going to have three Switch 2s, it makes it easier to share games, because when my daughter wants to play the game, she can just pop it in and she owns that key. The license just makes it possible for her to play. She still has to download it. But, you know, there is that convenience, and you can sell it and you're selling the key. So that's possible, too. So there are definitely some advantages there over just a strict digital purchase. Yeah. But overall, I think if I am playing a game that I don't intend to share with a family, digital just becomes easier, because then you don't have to keep track of that cartridge.
But there is a concept of like a digital lending library, right?
There is, yeah. And I guess I'd have to look more closely at how that works. And you're right, maybe that solves the problem. But sometimes it's just easier to have the old physical solution. It's like it's like a library book on your shelf type of thing. But it is kind of dismaying to me, just because, as I mentioned earlier, I love buying old games. It's really fun for me to do that. And 20 years from now, you walk into a retro shop and these Switch 2 cartridges are not going to be meaningful at all. And we know that Nintendo shuts all this stuff down over a period of time.
It'll be interesting if they slightly change the tack there, given the direction they're going with this kind of key in the cartridge thing. You know, 20 years from now is certainly different than 10 years from now, but I would be surprised if they didn't make it have a little more legs for the folks that are shelling out, you know, $90 for a cartridge digital key type solution, to make sure that those things are available in the long term, or at least medium term.
You would hope so. But as a long-term collector that is always thinking about what things are going to be worth down the line, I'm so happy I held on to my vanilla PlayStation 4 that has the PT demo. The demo that Kojima created for Silent Hills, which that makes that PlayStation 4 a lot more valuable, because it's the only way you can play it is if somebody has still kept it on their hard drive.
On the hard drive. Until the hard drive degrades.
Right. But I wonder if that's kind of one of the new things for collectors is collecting machines that have the stuff actually on it with all of the updates.
Certainly. I it's funny. I just read an article about a prepper hard drive that's basically a hard drive that's got a backup of Wikipedia, all these TED Talks around survival and establishing a new existence, and also content that has been since scrubbed from government websites. So I do think that there is a need to kind of figure out digital preservation, because the idea of physical media is becoming less and less important in video games. So I think the preservation aspect is an important topic, and actually one that we might want to focus on in future podcast.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Well, so just wanted to kind of wrap up the Switch 2 talk by giving you kind of some blow-by-blow details as to how I was able to get my pre-orders.
Yeah.
So Nintendo, of course, they said, oh, there's going to be enough for everyone. No problem. No problem at all. We're definitely going to be able to fulfill the demand. And I would say no. I'd say this is just as painful as PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series X. The type of experience where they tell you when the pre-orders are going to start and they list as sold out less than a minute after the doors open.
Oh yeah, it was grim. And I think the signal that it was going to be troublesome was when they announced the previous week that the Japanese pre-order kind of far exceeded their expectations. So the writing was kind of on the wall.
I got some numbers on that. The Switch 1, they did a similar thing where you could indicate interest. And in Japan, they had a huge number at the time, which was 350,000+ people, right? So 350,000 people were like, oh, we want to be able to get it right away.
And it was 2.2 million this time, yeah?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So exponentially more interest, which is super interesting. I think that that's the case for early adopters. I still don't think that this will sell as well as the Switch 1, the Switch 2. I think it is too much of kind of a half step for the most casual person to believe that they absolutely need it, but we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. They're projecting it to be the one of the investment banks and projecting it to be the biggest console launch ever.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. Well, I certainly have contributed to that because the way I ended up getting the three Switches that I felt we needed, one for me, of course, one for my son for his birthday. It launches the same week that he turns 15, which is pretty cool. And a graduation present for my daughter. Just seems like a good fit all around and great excuses for me to get one for each family member. But that, of course, triples the difficulty of trying to satisfy day one for my family. And, I was getting just a headache thinking about just even trying to do that. So we set up a bank of laptops at my house that night when they said 9 p.m. it's going to be available as a pre-order. And my wife sat in front of her laptop, my daughter in front of hers, and me in front of mine. Best Buy, I couldn't even log in to my Best Buy account. Fortunately, I was already logged in on my phone. So Best Buy said 9 o'clock was when they were doing it. They didn't actually start selling until about 9:30. So that was kind of a frustration because he kept refreshing and it kept saying coming soon. Walmart seemed to be the one fewer people were looking at because my wife got into line for that pretty quickly. And they just put her into a queue and said, like, just hold on 7 minutes. You'll be able to put it in your cart. And it actually did process and went through. Target, repeatedly, my daughter was able to get it into her cart, and it got pulled out of the cart and just could never complete the sale. And so at the end of the evening, on my phone, I was able to get in-store delivery for Best Buy, which I was very happy about. My wife was able to get the Walmart one, and again, Target was a bust. So the next day, GameStop had said, oh, we're going to have some machines that you can order in person. And I didn't want to take time off from work to do it. I really had zero interest in going overnight to just sit in front of a store. Those days are a little bit beyond me. So I dropped my son off at school. I ended up grabbing a breakfast, did some email. And then I was like an hour before they opened, and they opened at noon. I was like, okay, I'll see. Like, there's no way there's not going to be 200 people waiting in line for this thing, but I checked it out, and I was the 27th person there, and they had a total of 40 machines that they were going to sell. So I was able to just wait an hour to be able to get in there and get one more that's guaranteed for me. And I felt so badly, since it was just one per customer, there's no advantage provided you were in the first 40. One guy had gotten there at 8 p.m. the night before.
Ho, ho, ho. Yeah, well.
Well, you know, I mean, he was first in line.
Yeah.
he got his. Yeah, so now I have three. And I hope that the account transfer stuff is seamless, because that can sometimes be a headache too when you have, you know, a parent account and two kids accounts. And, you know, my daughter's 18 now, so should she have a kids account, or, you know, how do you upgrade that? And, you know, but that's all fun stuff to experience on June 5th. I'm excited that we're all going to be able to do it and have a lot of fun playing Mario Kart, which is a perfect launch game, because that's something we'll be playing until Switch 3, and probably on Switch 3 if they let us.
Definitely. Yeah, I was able to get a Walmart. I tried Target, but it just kind of seemed like the site had crashed when I went there. So I got into Walmart's line, and I was in line for half an hour, 40 minutes with no timer, no indication. And I just thought that maybe I was SOL. And then it finally, I think I refreshed the page and it put me through the transaction. I was able to get one. So
excellent.
Pretty happy about it and looking forward to the launch in June.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to talk about that at length. And I really am excited to know, anyone who's listening to this episode, whether they were successful in getting theirs and if they're looking forward to the launch. Crazy to think that it's 39 days away. It's so soon.
At the time of this recording.
Yeah. 39 days, right, yes. At the time of this recording is Switchmas, ladies and gentlemen. So, yeah.
Mark your calendars and let us know. Thanks for listening.